And good morning to you. I'm Ellen Speer, and you're listening to Morning Drive on WTBR 89.7 FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. And I am thrilled to have Tony Scalzo of Fastball here with us today. The band is going to be at Tanglewood on July 8th. They are touring with Bare Naked Ladies, and they're part of the Tanglewood Popular Artist Series. So welcome. I'm delighted that you're here. Have you been to the Berkshires before?
No, I have not.
And when do you have any time to get out and about, or you're on stage in and out of here?
Well, depending on a day off or not, there's only ever one day off between a cluster of shows.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, depending on how that's going at the moment, I usually have days free.
Yeah, so, yeah.
So, you know, if there's things around within walking distance, that usually works well. We were just in Salt Lake City, and the theater we were playing at was a botanical garden at the university.
Oh, that sounds gorgeous.
Yeah, so things like that. I might go fishing later.
There you go. So your band has a baker's dozen or more of albums. One of them went platinum. You had a chart-topping single. You've been together since 1994. Can you tell me the origin story? How did you all meet in Austin, and how did you all decide that you were going to have a band?
Miles and Joey basically came of age in Austin and went to UT there, you know, University of Texas in Austin. I, while they were in college in Austin, I was living in California. I grew up in Southern California, and I basically did what I could out there until I got an opportunity to move to Austin and play music there with other artists. And when those things didn't really materialize as hoped, I happened to be in a circle of friends, and Joey and Miles were part of that. And we were all sort of at an impasse personally in our careers, so we were trying to figure out what to do. And we, you know, the powers that be brought us together, and we started working right away.
Yeah. Now, there was about how much time, years before your hit, before the hit album? You had one album, and then the second album was the hit.
Yeah, about 4 years before that happened. But our, you know, our path seemed to be, you know, working its way upward, you know, in a gradual way. Before we got, we got signed to Hollywood Records within a year of being a band. And then, you know, we put together our first album, and we toured in sort of the college radio circuit.
How did you get noticed, do you think, by Hollywood?
Sorry?
How did you get noticed by Hollywood, do you think?
Since I was from California and had been, you know, roughly on the outskirts of the music business there, I happened to be playing a show with these guys under a different name. We were called Magneto then.
Okay.
So we're playing this show, just a regular rock show in the middle of the week in the Hole in the Wall in Austin, Texas. And I recognized a guy I had worked with in California, in L.A., named Julian Raymond. And I just couldn't understand why he was there. I'm like, what are you doing here? And he goes, well, I'm here with a fellow A&R guy, and we're coming to see this band. And I go, yeah, my band's playing tonight. And he goes, I said, what's the name of your... I go, who are you coming to see? And he said, Magneto.
There you go.
That's my band.
Yeah.
So he had gotten... He had gotten a good review. He had read a review in CMJ, which College Music Journal back in the day. It was sort of an indie zine. And he read a good review by a local reporter that we knew in Austin named Andy Langer. And they decided to come check us out. And we made an agreement to meet up in New York a little bit later for the CMJ conference, and that's where we met with Rob Seidenberg, and he signed this.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you put out the first album, and you did a lot of work, and you kept going and going and going. Was there ever a moment where you thought, this is crazy? What are we doing this for? Let's call it a day.
I think, though it didn't look like things were happening, we knew we had, it was what we had. We were going to work with it anyway.
Yeah.
We were able to come out. We had a manager. We had a label. We knew we were going to be able to do another record. And, you know, we weren't exactly terribly excited with the first album as a piece of music. I mean, it's okay and everything, but we really wanted to expand our musical, you know, output.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so it was a gradual thing where we felt like we were being successful.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, we had a hit record with the second record, with The Way and Out of My Head, Firescape.
Were you all kind of incredulous that The Way took off and the album went platinum? Did you expect this? Did you know that this is really a special piece of work?
I knew it was special, but I didn't know it was commercially viable. And I thought it would be a hidden track on that record. I really did. I didn't know. I didn't see how.
Yeah.
I don't understand things like that. And I don't think really anybody else does.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, they just take the credit when it happens.
There you go. Take the bow and keep moving. Now, you played a lot of concerts and you've done a lot of studio work. Do you have a preference?
No, they're two different animals, and I think I'm going to do both as long as I can.
Yeah. Is there?
I love playing live. It's fantastic. And I like making records. Different kind of experience all the way.
Is there a different kind of energy when you walk into a studio? Talk about that.
I like to think as I don't like to think too much when I'm playing live.
Yeah.
Get into a headspace where you're engaged with the bandmates and engaged with the audience, and you're not, you know, analyzing anything. But I also, you know, on the other side of the coin is the making, creating a record or recording in a studio. You're adjusting all kinds of things. So you're analyzing the crap out of it. You're just really turning it inside out. And,
yeah.
So I like that too. It's kind of to me. I mean, I'm not a film director or anything like that. I know a few people who are, and I sort of relate it to making tiny films, you know, that are basically audio. But
yeah, speaking of films, a lot of people may have come to Fastball through Buffy the Vampire Slayer and your music on it. How did that happen?
I don't know.
Not your department?
You know, you get a publishing deal and you get placement and things. And I think we've had a lot of things and they just don't. I mean, that's a long time ago. And I'm not even sure what song or what you're referring to.
Yeah, a couple of your tracks were used as music on that series. Yeah, you've not seen them, I guess.
A few of our songs have been featured in Disney films, like made-for-TV movies. There was one that I particularly liked called Johnny Tsunami.
Oh, yeah, I know that one. Yeah.
A bunch of our songs are on that. And then Miles has a song called Sooner or Later. It was on The Waterboy, and he's never even seen that movie. I can tell you. Every time it's on, he watches it for 10 minutes, and he can't stand it. So he doesn't wait long enough to hear the 10 seconds his song is in that movie.
Now so this music was not purpose written. It was tracks that you'd already recorded that somebody heard and picked up and said that'll be perfect.
If people would ask me to do that, I mean, I think we could do things like that, but no one ever has. It's always just existing music.
Now a lot of bands, you hear all the kind of big breakup stories about bands and reconfiguring and breaking up again. But you guys have been together for a remarkable amount of time. How do you do that?
Well, we've definitely come in and out of each other's orbits, or at least, you know, closer at times and then you know, sort of spreading apart a little bit, but we've never really broken up, and we've always done stuff every year. We've done stuff. The least activity we had as a band was, you know, 2020, just because of the pandemic.
Because of the way the world was.
And then we worked really hard at creating new material, and we even did a couple of live stream things, and Miles did a thing every week on Zoom.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you play the most variation in instruments of anybody in the band, not only vocals, but bass, keyboards, and guitar. How does that work? You just do what's needed?
Well, we don't have to hire so many people. And at the same time, we love to use other people because, you know, just like a film, you know, there are those films where it's produced, directed, and starring, you know?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
I think that for us, we like to work with producers so we get good ideas. And we like to work with other musicians. You know, I'm proficient on a low level at all those instruments.
Yeah.
I prefer to sometimes to use people that I believe can do something better, you know, and there's times where we've called in really great players and, you know, ran through take after take after take and then just settled on the one I originally did.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I noticed that you all played with Billy Preston. How was that experience?
It was surreal.
In what way?
Just because, you know, we'd seen the film Let It Be
and
grew up listening to Nothing from Nothing and Will It Go Round in Circles and seen him play with the Rolling Stones. And so, I mean, yeah, it was like having a Beatle in there as far as I'm concerned. I will say, you know, no disrespect, but the guy didn't seem very happy to be there and he didn't seem very, like, he didn't really want to get to know us in any way.
Yeah.
He wanted this thing and get the hell out of there. But he did a lot of great stuff for the song You're an Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just blown away to have him in there. I mean, he's nice enough. He was nice enough.
Yeah. Do you feel like something came out of that music that changed the way you approach things from how he played with you all?
You know, it's funny because he did exactly what I wanted him to do. What I was, like, hoping he would do and expecting he would do.
Yeah.
That's just that particular case, though. I mean, I was really familiar with his work, so I kind of knew what to expect. There's others where I didn't have any idea what to expect of me.
Yeah.
But Spencer came in and did some stuff on guitar for a song called Love is Expensive and Free, and that's all on our – all that stuff is on our third album, Harsh Light of Day, after we had a hit. So see, it was a lot easier to get people like that to come into the studio.
Yeah.
Because you have a hit record on the radio at the time.
So did you have particular people in mind to bring in as you put together songs saying, gee, I'd really like to have so-and-so on this?
Yes, I did. In fact, that song, You're an Ocean, the one that Billy worked with us on, also has a really great steel guitar, you know, like a lap steel guitar.
Uh-huh.
And hoping to get David Lindley in there, who was Jackson Browne's guitar player for a long time, but he wasn't available. But we were able to get another guy whom I really have become friends with and really love his work, is a guy named Marty Rifkin.
Mm-hmm.
So he's the guy who plays that guitar stuff on You're an Ocean.
Yeah, yeah. Now, how did the collaboration with Bare Naked Ladies come about? You've got quite an ambitious tour schedule with them this year.
They asked us a couple of years, well, more like 8 years ago, if we would go out with them and Violent Femmes, and we were already booked for something, and we had to turn it down. And fortunately, that wasn't a fluke, and they asked us again this year to do their big American tour. And we had worked with them back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
We played on the Horde tour with them in 1998. And that was the final Horde tour which was a thing run by John Popper from Blues Traveler.
Yeah.
Bare Naked Ladies became friends with us back then, but we hadn't seen them or spoken with them in, 25 years. And here we are back together, and it's like we were never apart.
Yeah. What is it musically that you find that gels with what Fastball's all about?
Musically, I believe that Fastball, the Bare Naked Ladies, and the other opening act on this tour is Guster. I think all three of us are super imaginative songwriters, capable singers, good musicians, and that's how it works with this tour, I think. That's where we have a lot in common.
Yeah.
None of it is shaped by trend or you know, you couldn't tell me if you were from another country or if I was from another country and you told me all these bands were from the 90s. Well, maybe Guster's a little bit later, but
yeah.
I wouldn't know. I wouldn't have any idea because it sounds like it doesn't really have any era attached to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you've had many influences along the way.
Before, yes, that's right. I mean, as we were traveling and you know, meeting different bands and artists, you know, yeah, those influences definitely come in. We realize, hey, I'd like to do that too, that kind of thing too. Rather, you know, it's better than just, you know, we're not the Ramones. You know, the Ramones, you know, they stuck to the thing that they did, and thank God they did.
Yeah.
But we have to, you know, and others might argue that we're still just playing pop music with hooks and guitars and melodies. And at the same time, I think we're not really standing in one place, though.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell me about the songwriting process. Who's involved and how does it start? Does somebody walk into the studio one day and say, hey, listen to this. What do you think? What can we build on this? Or does it form, fully formed?
Yeah. So we live about 30 miles apart in a weird sort of line. So we don't see each other too much when we're at home. And that's when the songwriting stuff really happens. And it's usually individual stuff. It's me and Miles. I work on stuff at my house, and he works on stuff. We don't have a studio, and we don't rehearse regularly. And we rehearse when it's time to get ready to do something. We've been together long enough to really not have to see each other constantly. And that helps us, too. And your answer, another answer to your previous question, how do you stay together? Well, maybe you keep a little distance in place. And then you get together when it's time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when you...
On my own, Miles writes on his own. Sometimes we collaborate in a manner where it's I've written something and can you finish this? Or he's written, you know, vice versa. So most of our material are non-collaborative as far as writing.
So you just walk into the studio with a chart and say, here's what I got. Let's try it.
No, you walk into the studio having already know, everybody knows the song because we've already done pre-production and rehearsed and get it all together. And studios cost a lot of money, so you go in there when you've got everything ready. You try to spend as little time laying down basic tracks, bass, drums, guitar. You want to spend a bulk of your time messing with it. As far as I'm concerned, I like to go in and like, okay, we got this basic thing down, this skeletal structure. Now let's add some color to it. Let's put some hair on it. And, you know, that kind of thing really is the fun part of making records. So in a way, we're all Joey, Miles, myself, we're producers of music.
Yeah.
And we still like to have someone come in, either as an engineer who does all the technical stuff, and we boss them around, or we have a producer who bosses us around. And, you know, all of that works for us very well.
Yeah. How do you like it best? Do you like best being your own producers, or do you like that collaboration of having an engineer and a producer and you concentrate on making music?
Yeah, well, I can't say like what do I like most, because we do what works for what project it is.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's split up, you know. I mean, we put out a record just before this one called The Deep End, and half of that stuff is self-produced and half of it's produced by Steve Berlin.
Okay. And do you have an engineer that you've worked with a long time, or it's who happens to be in the studio? And
yeah, usually it's who happens to be in the studio or who the producer prefers to work with.
Mm-hmm. And when you're producing yourself, do you have people that you prefer, or you just do your own thing based on what they're laying down for you?
Yeah, there's a guy named Charlie Kramsky in Austin that we've worked with, and we made a bunch of songs with him and us sort of self-producing. David Garza likes to use the people who work at Sonic Ranch, and that's where we recorded this last album. And also, a lot of our records are mixed by Bob Clearmount out in Los Angeles, and he's done everybody that you can think of, the Rolling Stones and Jackson Brown and just hundreds of great artists. Roxy Music, Avalon was one of his records, and he's a mix engineer, probably one of the best in the world.
Yeah, and your sound is remarkably consistent throughout your career, from the beginning to even your most current album. There's definitely a sound and a sonic feel that you create that's very much your own. That just happens? That just in your mixing, in your...
I think it happens because both Miles and Joey and myself, we have the same ears that we had back then, and our six ears are that's the funnel through which it goes into our brain and our collective thing. So yeah, that's probably why there's so much consistency in the sound of the band.
And there's three of you, but you create a sound that's feels much bigger and sounds much richer. Like there's more people on stage if you're sitting here between two speakers.
Yeah, you mean on recordings?
Yeah,
So on recordings, like I said, we love to play with that basic bass drum and guitar thing. In some cases, maybe a piano. And then we add tons of stuff. And we do it ourselves or we hire somebody, but we're there, you know? And that's it. You know, I love to have a lot of things going on. I love minimal stuff too, you know? But for the most part, I want all kinds of textures and things. And now, on the other side of that is the live show. So, you know, some of our hits have a lot going on in them. So we can't really pull it off just me and Miles and Joey. And sometimes we can't afford to take anybody out with us. So we've recorded all kinds of backing tracks that we add to some of the songs, you know, and some of the songs don't have them. They don't need them. But like The Way and Out of My Head's got that organ and stuff. And The Way has this sort of like, you know, nutty backing track that it begins with. And then the band kind of closes in on it on the second verse. Mm-hmm. So we use tracks on stage, not in a way that, you know, and I like to say, well, if you don't like it, you know, too bad.
You know, it's interesting because in listening to some of your live tracks, they're very polished, you know, from what I'm used to hearing.
That's also the tightness of the band, and I give Joey, our drummer, number one credit for that, because he's probably one of the most solid just great, strong drummer, and not too fancy. He lets the music breathe, and he gives it everything it needs.
Yeah, yeah. In your prep for the Bare Naked Ladies tour, would I be hearing the same thing in one city that I'm going to be hearing in another city?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, we only got a 30-minute set, so
okay.
It's only songs. But we were able to pretty much kill it.
How do you keep it fresh?
Oh, who cares?
Sounds like you have fun with what you're doing.
Fresh or not, we're already done by the time we're warmed up, and so it's great. This tour has been insanely great. We're used to suffering out on the road with bands.
What do you mean?
Well, it's rough, you know. Sometimes buses don't work. Air conditioning isn't happening. There's no place to shower. You get a day off with a hotel, maybe, but then you got to get on the bus at 2 a.m. to go to the next place. And, you know, you try to make... I don't want to whine about my fantastic job, but, I mean, this tour, I feel like everybody's on the same page, like, personally. And there's a lot of respect, mutual respect, which sometimes is rare.
Yeah. So that life on the road is not that exciting dream that everybody thinks about, huh?
You don't have time to do anything. You have time to squeeze in a couple trips. And I will say the guys in Guster are geniuses at that.
Yeah.
They get out of the bus early and split somewhere before they have to be back at like 3 to do a sound check and have to hang around. And even after they're set, they'll run around somewhere, maybe jump in the, if we're by the water, they'll jump in the water and go swimming at night. they're fun. And, you know, we've tried to figure out where the hiking spots are or, you know, the museums or things like that. There's no way we can go visit any nightlife stuff or other bands or see any other, you know, shows because, you know, by the time we're done doing what we're doing, it's all over. Plus we're usually playing in arenas or amphitheaters that are out in the middle of, you know, not walking distance.
Yeah, to places. Anything.
Yeah, so, yeah.
So when you're not working and when you're doing that a part time, do you go listen to music then by yourselves to other groups? And
yeah, I mean, we live near Austin. Jim Miles lives in Austin. And I've lived there for, you know, 32 years since I moved there. And I only just recently moved somewhat out of town. And there's not a lot going on in my small town. But I occasionally go into Austin and see local bands. You know, I have to mention this because you know about it. It's a great music scene. Always has been. But a lot of the people in our time, which is the late 80s all the way up to like 2000, early 2000s in Austin, everybody's in their 50s now and 60s, some in their 40s. But there's a lot of daytime things on the weekend. And I love to go 5 miles. I got to go, you know, I don't want to drive home at 2 o'clock in the morning. So I do stuff during the day and see a lot of great bands who are all like, you know, they're all older people, but they're doing great music.
There's something about our generation that continues. We don't stop. I've noticed.
And we don't all play covers.
Yeah. Yeah.
We write our own music and our own songs. And I'm afraid there's, you know, I know there's a lot of great original music coming from young people right now, but I see so many covers and videos. It's like, man, write your own song. You do that so good, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought for just a minute because we're going to be taking a short break, and then we will be back with more of Morning Drive.
Stay tuned for more Morning Drive here on WTBR-FM. You're tuned to Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield and 88.1 WSBR Lee.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. Free community college for any Massachusetts resident without a bachelor's degree at BCC. Find out more at berkshirecc.com. Sundrini.edu, and from Sundrini Awnings and Home Improvement, providing awnings and canopies in Western Mass. Retractable awnings, retractable screens, gutter and gutter protection systems, commercial awnings and screen rooms. Customized solutions available. Online at Sandrini.com.
PCTV Select is now available on so many platforms. You can get it with any device you have available, all free to download and use. If you're watching at home, use your Roku, Amazon, Fire TV, or Apple TV device, or even your computer, and see programming in full HD quality. Watching on the go? Download PCTV Select from the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store for your smartphone. It's that easy and free. PCTV Select is everywhere you need to be.
BRTA offers training to any person or group new to using the bus system or the process. We have a certified travel trainer that will make the process easier. Our travel trainer will ride the bus with you until you are more comfortable with how everything works. They can teach you about fares, how to read the schedules, how to get on or off the bus, and pedestrian safety. If you are interested in this service, please email traveltraining@berkshirerta.com.
Support for this public service announcement comes from Berkshire Community College and Park Square Productions.
Let's have a party.
Hey friends, if you're looking for some party music, tune in to Polka Express with me, Bill Gustavus, every Wednesday night from 6 to 8, and Sunday mornings from 8 to 10, right here on 89.7 WTBR, Pittsfield, Massachusetts.
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs to help our community thrive. Greylock Federal, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org. And from UCP of Western Massachusetts. UCP of Western Mass is hiring full and part-time opportunities to provide a life without limits for people with disabilities. For more information, ucpwma.org/jobs.
You have chosen wisely.
WTBR.
And now back to the morning drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. And good morning to you. I'm Ellen Speer, back with Morning Drive, and my wonderful guest today, Tony Scalzo of the band Fastball. They're going to be with us at the Shed at Tanglewood on Tuesday, July 8th. They're touring with Bare Naked Ladies, and I really appreciate the time that you've taken to be with us here today. We were talking right before the break about why people who kind of started their rock and roll plateau in the 60s, 70s, and 80s are still doing it, are still singer-songwriters, are still putting it out there in small clubs and in big venues. And there seems to be a very different kind of sound and feel to that community than contemporary artists. Not that one is different or better than the other, but it's just different. How do you think about that?
Well, more and more, I just feel like, you know, I couldn't relate to big band jazz that my father liked. And he couldn't relate to the Beatles or anybody with long hair. So, you know, maybe it's just that. Maybe it's just generational, and we just don't get what they're up to. But I don't know.
Some people have suggested that with the advent of the attention to commercial success, that there's less of an emphasis on writing, you know, Dylan lyrics that are going to survive forever because that's not going to fit in the box, however that box is defined, that becomes a commercial hit.
Yeah, I mean, I've never written a song for commercial purposes. Like, I never thought, like, any of my songs would be hits. And the ones that I maybe thought they might be, of course, they weren't. And so it's just like...
So, and music is a reflection of its time. So, and your band has had to change as the time has changed somewhat. How would you describe that kind of living in the moment? Because otherwise you become like a nostalgia band, and you're not that.
Yeah, I mean, people have tried to paint us that way. And mainly we run on those hits that we created in the late 90s. So, you know, we're all constantly on bills with, you know, like era bands, you know, the same sort of time. But, you know, advances have been made in technology. You can make records a lot quicker and cheaper than you used to, just because of Pro Tools replacing tape.
Yeah.
That was very complicated, and you had to, you know, you had to erase tape if you wanted to do more stuff, and or you had to buy more tape, and you'd see these big boxes on studio floors with like
32 track tapes.
So all that's pretty much gone. You know, there are people still doing the analog thing, but I mean, it's only, it's like, why, when you can just, you can do great quality work digitally and a lot faster, and you could do unlimited takes, and edits are way easier to do. You don't have to actually take a razor blade and cut a window into the tape,
right?
Which is really what people would do back in those, in the, all the way up to the 90s.
Yeah, I come from the era of cutting tape myself, so I resemble that. Now, did you have to teach yourself, because it's quite, you know, Pro Tools is not Microsoft Word, so it's a little more to it. Did you teach yourself?
I can't even do Microsoft Word.
Yeah,
I have taught myself in my own way, Logic Pro, which is a sort of Mac version of Pro Tools that's kind of user friendly, and just, you know, as soon as I get proficient in that, they go and change it and add all this AI stuff to it. So, you know, who knows? Maybe AI will be a thing that helps or enhances music making and creativity. Hopefully it's not used as a, you know, a steroid.
Yeah, yeah. So you all go in with, you know, your equipment in the production phase, and you just play around, see what sounds good?
Yeah, after things are sort of done, and if we feel like something's not working, we either abandon it or try to switch gears on it, maybe try to do the backing tracks again.
And when you lay down tracks in a studio session, you all play together at once?
We like to put the basic tracks together, yeah.
All together.
Live. Sometimes we may scrub some of those tracks, and the only thing that's left are the drums, and
again,
you know, like, and the vocals are always done separately,
right,
and later,
right?
More concentrated vocal session situation.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take just a second, and we're going to actually listen to The Way now, so people know what we're talking about. So listen to this. It's The Way by Fastball.
They made up their minds and they started packing. They left before the sun came up that day. An exit to eternal summer slacking.
Could see the road that they walk on.
We just listened to The Way by Fastball. We have in the studio today Tony Scalzo of the group The Fastball, and they're going to be at Tanglewood July 8th. So what did you do on that track?
And I played bass on it, I think. That's about it.
Yeah. What, do you remember when you got the news that it was topping the charts? And the thing was really taking off. Do you remember how you were told? What happened?
Well, I was actually in the office of the record company with the band. And the president of the label, Bob Cavallo, told us that it was probably going to hit number one on the modern rock charts within a couple of weeks because it was already tracking, you know, like number 17, number 11, and it was looking like it was going to go all the way, and the label, the office was buzzing, just like new people were showing up at the label and radio promo people and, you know, publicity people, just all stacking up to work this record. A lot of radio station visits and amazing to be going. Like, I was able to sort of be with my parents in Orange County, so mm-hmm. I was able to go to the label office a bit during that time. We had to do a lot of stuff there in Los Angeles so that we could set it all up for, you know, the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And so a lot of you know, driving around. And I remember being on my way to the label and being on the freeway in traffic, and Jed the Fish from KROQ announced it. Yeah. It was like drive time. It's like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And, you know, I was looking at everybody in the cars next to me and going, how many of these people are listening to this stuff right now? And I knew quite a few had to be.
Yeah. Now, do you think there's some regionality to it? Did you have a sense that around Austin, where you guys were, you were already more well-known? And
We were definitely more well-known in Austin. And it's only because Austin was not a giant city. It was small, and maybe 500,000 in the whole region at that time. And everybody in the music scene knew everybody else.
Yeah.
And the radio station people we all knew and all the writers from the Austin Chronicle and the American Statesman. We knew all of that people. And so, yeah, there was a huge buzz with us. We were able to open up for bands like let's just say bigger bands. Everclear, and we opened up for, I remember, Supergrass, and I was really excited about that. They were an English band. We're just starting to feel that love locally. And then, you know, I had lots of friends in Southern California, so they were all excited.
Yeah.
And my parents were very excited. And, yeah, it was a really great time.
So, and then the album went platinum shortly thereafter.
Yeah, probably about 6 months later. Yeah, it sold a lot of copies in a very short time.
Yeah. Now the game has changed. Now it's not going to radio stations and trying to get them to flog your record. It's a million different outlets on platforms that the artists put their stuff up. And how do you approach that now to get the ears to your songs? Because you got to kind of do it, or your team has to do it all themselves.
Yeah, you kind of have to get your management to work with people who do social media and people who understand how streaming works. We're getting more and more, proficient. That's a word I use a lot, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's a big learning curve for us, and we're... you know, two of us are in our 60s. We're trying.
Yeah. But, I've seen you.
My eyes aren't so good. And to do all this work on a little cell phone is so difficult for me. Mm. And, you know, I try to post something and I think I've posted it. And then I can't find it. So I post it again. And then it's up there twice.
You are not alone, my friend.
You know, a Spotify. One thing I do know, that Apple Music and Spotify and all these formats that stream your music, there are benefits for us. Absolutely. Because when you have a hit record, you're going to get streamed, and you're going to get streamed for life. When you sold a record back in the day, you sold a record and you sold it one time. And that's it. No more revenue from that record.
Yeah.
And so these days, our numbers just keep compounding and building on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Music. And, you know, what may be a bummer for independent artists who've never really sold a lot of records is a boon for someone like the Bare Naked Ladies or Fastball, who have songs that everybody knows, or maybe they don't know who the band, you know, but it's helping us to get a profile where we couldn't at the time. Thinking about what you said about the radio, and yeah, I don't know what, if there's any radio people anymore, you know, those people driving around.
And yeah, I used to be one of those people. Yeah. So
on the phone, looking at directions and signs and talking to you at the same time. Please drive. Just drive the car.
So you're saying that the platforms like Spotify and others, where you look and you have so many million monthly listeners and so forth, if you've already got Sagan.
You're working to boost those numbers and keep them.
Yeah. So if you've already got some flywheel behind you and some energy, then they really propel you. What advice would you have for somebody starting out to try to get known, to try to get that traction started? Assuming the music's good, of course.
It's like you have to have a stunt of some kind.
A stunt?
Some kind of, I don't know, some gimmick.
Yeah.
Gimmicks out there, but there are bands I think that do it organically.
Yeah,
I've been watching the career of Krungbin. You know that band?
I don't.
Houston, they're a three-piece from Houston. They're international famous right now because they're mainly instrumental, very exotic, guitar, bass, drums, Just vibey as all get out. Yeah. And also King Gizzard and the Wizard Lizard, they do it organically.
Yeah.
Wizard, excuse me. They make records, and they do it the old-fashioned way, and they pump them out, and they're all high quality. And then they tour around the world, and they just go and just, while they're young, they do as much work as they possibly can.
Yeah. Now, I notice you've got some videos, too. It seems like you got to have a video.
It does. It seemed like that for us back. That's what they told us in 1995.
Really?
Sure, because MTV and VH1,
that was
the deal. And that's the only way you were going to get a big hit. And that's why we had such a big hit, because we shot a video with my buddy McGee back in from Orange County. And he shot The Way. And, you know, it's got all that color and all that bright lights and all those gimmicks that you see in Korn video, Smash Mouth, Bare Naked Ladies.
Yeah.
All done in that style of, you know, high 90s, you know, high contrast.
But you're still making them, aren't you? You're still making videos.
Yeah, we don't spend $150,000 on them. No, we spend about $5,000.
Yeah.
You know, we try to get young people to make fun and easy and cheap videos. It doesn't really matter if it's cinematographically, you know, superior anymore. I think that a lot of people just want a lyric video too.
What do you mean by that, a lyric video?
Well, you know, you see a lot of like, say you heard a song and you want to check out what it's all about. There might be a couple of you know, video loops of them within the song, but mainly it's the lyrics printed up on the screen.
Ah, okay.
And young people like to check that out, I'm told.
Yeah. You think people like to see the band playing, too?
I know they do, yes. I think we're an exciting band to watch. We're not exactly jumping around. We got a lot of stuff to do, multitasking, singing and playing. And, you know, so we're basic music players, and we try to give the best performance we can, but we also, you know, we have to, you know, concentrate on what we're doing, too.
Yeah. So with your videos, do you all decide where you place them, or do you have folks who are kind of expert on where to put this stuff and when? And
you know, I think that I think YouTube, having your own YouTube page is crucial.
Yeah.
And having your own Instagram and Facebook pages are important. I don't have a TikTok page myself. I don't think the band really does either. Our stuff may appear on TikTok through fans, and you know, like I said, we're trying to chase. I think it's a waste of time, maybe, for us as people and artists to chase these things, these new developments, because I mean, I can't do it all. I'd rather concentrate on making art than content.
Yeah. And does your audience tend to be people in your age cohort, or how do you think about younger audiences?
They're usually about 10 years younger than us, because that was the demographic when we were out there.
Ah.
And so we were already in our early 30s when that song came out, and we were playing for teenagers and college kids. And so they're all grown up now, and they have families, and they drag their kids to our shows, and the kids seem to like it or tolerate it. But we do have a few younger fans popping up, and they seem to know everything. And, you know, they tell us that they discovered us on their own, and I love that. You know, because that's the way we all sort of discover the music that we love personally. You know, maybe we heard something on the radio and it reminds us of a time and a place. And I dig that about the organics of music.
That might work against, you know, bringing in younger audiences, because you a friend of mine described it as the rock and roll plateau. You kind of stay on your rock and roll plateau of wherever you were between 20 and 30, and that's the music you'll always love.
Everybody does that. I think that's human nature, and it's a real struggle, but I manage somehow to find new and fresh things for my ears, and naturally I go back to earlier times and the music, because there's still so much for me to discover, I've noticed.
Sure.
From those times and before my time.
Yeah. In our final minute, let me ask you, when was the moment where you decided that music was going to be your career, and did you have to do a lot of convincing in your family to do what you wanted to do?
Oh, yeah. So about 14 or 15, I was playing in a band with some older guys who were all, one was 21, so he got beer for us, and the rest were, you know, they were seniors in high school, so they had cars, and we played parties, and my parents were not into it, because I was, like, young.
Yeah.
And, you know, they'd have to come over to my house and convince my parents to let me come and play. And, you know, I had a hard time at jobs. I did jobs.
Yeah.
I worked, you name it, I've probably done it for at least a day or two. And I didn't really want to do that. I knew what I didn't want to do. I didn't want to punch a clock. You know, but I've had to struggle, and I've had to depend on girlfriends and typical male musician.
Life of a musician.
20th century. Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate your sharing your recollections with us today, and we're all really excited about looking forward to seeing you in Tanglewood. I've been talking with Tony Scalzo of Fastball. They're going to be at Tanglewood July 8th with Bare Naked Ladies, and we hope you enjoy the Berkshires and have a little bit of time at least to get out and about. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. All right.
Drive where you wanna go.